I next met with Dr. Saab, who delivered his presentation on GI cancers in the COVID-19 era.
I'm delighted to be presenting specifically in this interesting time that we live in this COVID-19 era, and discuss a little bit about how things are moving in gastrointestinal cancers and some of the things that we've adopted have changed a little bit how we practice. And some of this actually will be implemented to the future, even post-COVID. The clinical impact of COVID-19 overall is pretty obvious. There has been a bit of a data here and there about what happens to patients with cancer. Smaller studies have suggested that these patients tend to do worse. We actually were part of a large effort, the CCC19 consortium, that looked at specifically the impact of COVID-19 on patients with cancer. This was actually a large database, close to 1,000 patients. About 40% of those patients were on active treatment, and about half of those patients had active cancer. At the time of analysis, there were about 13% of patients who died. And that's compared to less than 5% for the overall population. In fact, it's closer to 2% for the overall population. So disproportionately, patients with cancer, especially those on treatment, seem to die at higher rate. And there were some factors that seem to be associated with an increased 30-day mortality. If the patients were older, male sex, and that's consistent, if they smoked, if they had lung cancer specifically, but more specifically, if their cancer was active, progressive versus remission, if they had comorbidities, and a number of other factors as well. So the 30-day all-cause mortality was relatively high compared to the general population. This just shows the impact of what we call on the top level, the A and B is focused on mortality. C and D is actually an all composite, includes mortality, oxygen utilization, ICU, etc. And what we see is, as your cancer is more advanced and more progressive, you're more likely to die from COVID-19. And if you have solid tumors or hematologic malignancies, the effect is about the same. And that includes for the composite data. On the other hand, when we look at the composite data, regardless of hematologic or solid tumors, it seems that it doesn't matter whether you're on therapy or not. Everyone seems to have a really tough time with COVID-19. And so the message from all this is that patients with cancer overall do worse if they catch COVID-19, and if they're on treatment or their cancer is more advanced and progressing, they do even worse, including dying at a much higher rate. So that's very important because that really affects the way we think about our practice. So what do we do, I mean, with all these patients with GI cancers at this point of time? We continue to implement these, although we've loosened them up now that our rates are going down, at least on our Arizona campus. We delay, defer non-essential clinic visits, if feasible. We're universally screening all patients for fever, cough, exposures at the clinic entrance, but preferably by phone prior to visits. So we're calling all these patients a day or two before and making sure that we go through a symptom management. Screening all patients on chemo and or IO. We're doing nasopharyngeal swab at routine intervals, now a little bit less frequently given that the rates are going down here, but you know, when they were going up, actually, we were a little bit more aggressive. A one-visitor policy, wearing surgical masks, goggles actually for our doctors and staff, facial coverings only for patients. And telemedicine has become part of our reality. We're doing quite a bit of telemedicine and creatively. Interestingly, Mayo Clinic has implemented telemedicine as a goal for the future before COVID-19, so this has accelerated this. If possible, avoid immunosuppressive therapies. But we realize that most patients still need, whether in the adjuvant setting or even in the palliative setting, they need chemotherapy. Avoiding prolonged exposure to intensive therapies. So we're quickly jumping onto these maintenance strategies, which, you know, I've been advocating for the longest time, but I think it becomes more important now. And then oral medicine whenever possible to avoid longer infusions or more frequent visits. If we look at the composite of data, whether the CCC19 data and others, I mean, there's obviously a signal that patients on IO may do a little bit worse. But that tends to be skewed to lung cancer, and lung cancer overall tend to do worse. So overall, IO patients have about the same risk that you see with chemotherapy. And so that's important to think in the confines of this particular study, which I think transformed how to treat MSI-high colorectal cancer, my viewpoint, actually, any MSI-high tumor. As you recall, Neil, I've implemented actually first-line Pembro for most of my patients with MSI-high when insurance was not arguing with us. But this study comes to consolidate this thought and for many practices change it. This was comparing pembrolizumab to chemotherapy and two co-primary endpoints, progression-free survival and overall survival, and this doubling of progression-free survival at the median. But if you look at the hazard ratio, it's 0.6. And when you go beyond 3 years, and these curves flatten, there's about one third of those patients on pembrolizumab that are going into their fourth year without progressive disease and alive. That's pretty amazing. And I think that by itself is important as we think about how to treat our patients with this therapy. Overall survival is still pending, but I tell you, first of all, I don't suspect overall survival is going to be any worse. But even if about the same, there's still the advantage of going with PD-1 inhibitors first or pembrolizumab first, given the fact that about one third of those patients will never see chemotherapy. So another study that transformed the way we treat colon cancer, and specifically looking at that subset of patients with BRAF V600E mutated colorectal cancer. And this is a subgroup of patients that does incredibly bad. Their prognosis is pretty bad. So this study specifically was looking at the biologics versus chemotherapy plus a biologic, encorafenib, RAF inhibitor plus binimetinib, MEK inhibitor plus cetuximab versus encocetux versus standard chemotherapy with a primary endpoint of overall survival and overall response rate. This study led to the approval of encorafenib plus cetuximab based on the positive data. And the updated data from ASCO 2020 continues to suggest a significant overall survival benefit with the biologics versus chemotherapy plus cetuximab with a significant hazard ratio. And what's interesting is that the doublet with encorafenib and cetuximab does as well as the triplet, and the quality of life of patients seem to be preserved or improved with the triplet and the doublet versus the control, meaning overall patients who actually end up on encorafenib plus cetuximab or plus minus binimetinib do better than the control. So how do we treat colorectal cancer at this point of time? If you have a right-sided tumor, EGFR inhibitors are not indicated. On the left side, it's a BEV or anti-EGFR plus chemotherapy. If you have an MSI-high tumor, it's pembrolizumab. No argument about it. KEYNOTE-177 established that. If you have a right-sided tumor, a BRAF V600E mutated tumor or a RAS mutated tumor, the preference, if eligible, patients goes on FOLFOXIRI plus bevacizumab. Second line is chemotherapy plus a switch of the biologic. Again, on the right side, still avoid anti-EGFR inhibitors. And if you have a BRAF V600E mutated tumor, you go on encorafenib plus cetuximab. So the RAF plus cetuximab based on the results of the BEACON. And then if you have a HER2 amplified tumor, and you have to check HER2 at the beginning of starting the treatment, because HER2 amplification do predict for EGFR inhibitor resistance. And so in those patients, with HER2 amplification, you may even consider HER2 target strategies beyond the first line, so second or third line, preferably on a clinical trial at this point of time, if available, and there are a few of them that are available. And then beyond that, regorafenib or TAS-102, and then finally, phase 1. So how did COVID-19 affect our treatment with metastatic colorectal cancer? So we've done this routinely, but now I think I can't but overemphasize the need to just get rid of the bolus 5-FU and the leucovorin if you're using FOLFOX, FOLFIRI, or FOLFIRINOX. That actually helps improve the immunosuppressive potential for these regimens. De-intensification strategies, so 3 months, no more than 4 months on the FOLFOX, FOLFIRI, or FOLFIRINOX, and then drop it to capecitabine plus minus bevacizumab, or even frankly for some patients, go for a holiday. That's okay. It doesn't affect their survival. May affect a little bit their PFS, but not much. Overall survival is not affected. For MSI-high tumors, I would avoid dual checkpoint inhibitor strategies because of the higher level of toxicities and stick to where the data is with pembrolizumab. In rare cases, you may consider every 6 weeks pembro. It doesn't have an approval for the MSI-high. There's no reason to think it doesn't work there. If you have to, you can move to every 6 weeks, but the standard is every 2 weeks. For the BRAF V600D mutated tumors, no delay for encorafenib and cetuximab beyond second line. You have to start those. Again, they're less immunosuppressive. It's important for those patients to be salvaged. And for refractory disease, I still prefer regorafenib, even more so now over TAS-102, to minimize the risk of immunosuppression. So now moving on to hepatocellular carcinoma and some of the earlier disappointments with PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors. based on negative studies, suggest that with most subgroup of patients, we may still see responses. And the question is, how do we enhance the likelihood of a response beyond single agent? And so multiple strategies have been designed and developed. One of the most promising target would be targeting VEGF because it essentially improves the immune milieu favorably to enhance the activity of PD-1, PD-L1 inhibitors. That was the basis of this IMbrave 150 study with atezolizumab and bevacizumab versus sorafenib. This led to positive data that now led to an FDA approval of atezolizumab and bevacizumab in the first line treatment of advanced HCC. The results of the study, again, are pretty impressive. And certainly in this disease, transformational. Survival was improved. PFS was improved. As you can see on top, the median overall survival is not even reached yet with atezo-bev. Now, this is an early look. But if you look at the curve going down, it's likely going to be close to 2 years median overall survival versus 13 months with sorafenib. And the PFS was improved at the median, although it may not look impressive, but the hazard ratio of 0.59 is pretty impressive. And then I have the dotted line here just to show you that beyond the 1 year, there is close to one quarter of the patients who remain progression-free and alive. So it's likely that for about 20 to 25% of the patients, these responses will remain durable beyond 1 year and likely beyond 2 years. So this transforms how we treat patients. Toxicities were better, and patient-reported outcomes favor atezo plus bev versus sorafenib. And that's not an unimportant piece. I mean, sorafenib, you can see that the quality of life deterioration happens close to 4 months. With atezo bev, the median is about 1 year, and that's a significant hazard ratio. So we improve all the segments that we care about to consider this as our first-line standard now is atezo bev. Second line, you know, my preference would be for regorafenib or cabozantinib. There are, of course, other options that you could consider. But to simplify treatment at this point of time, I'd go from atezo-bev in the first line, rego or cabo in the second line, and then consider third line cabozantinib. You could even consider nivo plus ipi for select patients in the third line if they're still doing great, although, again, less favored. There are a number of other studies that are looking at other strategies. LEAP looking at lenvatinib plus pembrolizumab versus lenvatinib, CheckMate for dual checkpoint inhibitor versus grafenib, lenvatinib, Himalaya doing the same with Durva, and then COSMIC-312 with cabo and atezolizumab. In pancreas cancer, we've had last year this phase 3 POLO trial, which looked at olaparib as frontline maintenance. It's more like a switch rather than a maintenance, meaning those patients who do well with platinum-based therapy, primarily FOLFIRINOX, were switched to olaparib versus placebo, showing an improvement in progression-free survival, but no improvement in median overall survival. Now, in the COVID area, of course, where we're trying to think more and more about less intense therapy and maintenance oral therapy, I turn your attention to this very interesting study. This was presented and published by Eileen O'Reilly's group, and looking at gemcitabine cisplatin with or without veliparib. Now, veliparib is not a meaningful PARP inhibitor, and so the focus is, frankly, on the results of gemcitabine cisplatin. I don't think veliparib added much, but you can see that the response rate, the composite response rate, is close to 70% with gemcitabine cisplatin, which is very similar to what you see with FOLFIRINOX. And there's preclinical data to suggest that cisplatin is better than oxaliplatin for patients with BRCA1, BRCA2, and perhaps PALB2. So in this COVID age, what do I do with my patients? If those patients have no alterations, BRCA, PALB2, I actually prefer gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel, and I defer back to my favorite regimen with biweekly gemcitabine nab-paclitaxel to minimize the risk of immunosuppression, and this, frankly, does not appear to compromise their outcomes. In the BRCA, PALB2 mutated patients, my preference is actually for gemcitabine cisplatin rather than FOLFIRINOX. And again, we published, and others have published data on biweekly gemcitabine cisplatin, which appears to preserve outcomes. That makes it less immunosuppressive, less toxic. Patients are less in need to come to the clinic. And I've treated patients for much longer than you'd ever think with gemcitabine and cisplatin every other week. But frankly, for some select patients who you think should avoid coming to the clinic after 4 months of gemcis, you could consider a switch to olaparib as this is oral. Keep in mind that olaparib is not necessarily the easiest drug. It still has some toxicities to the bone marrow to think about as well as you consider the switch. Finally, talking a little bit about gastroesophageal cancer and specifically a focus on some of the updated data from KEYNOTE-061. This is with pembrolizumab versus paclitaxel. As a reminder, our standard of care in the United States and in parts of the world is paclitaxel plus ramucirumab. So this study is really comparing to a suboptimal component or suboptimal standard, which is paclitaxel. What this study did, the initial data looked at CPS more than one. Then next follow-up was looking at CPS more or equal than 10. And then finally, in this data, they looked at CPS more or equal than 5 as the midway. I want to bring your attention primarily to the progression-free survival piece. And as you can see, with the CPS more or equal than 1, pembrolizumab underperforms until you hit about 15% of the patients where you see that separation. Same for the CPS more or equal than 5. It's only until you reach CPS more or equal than 10 that you see the separation happening a little bit earlier. Otherwise, there doesn't appear to be any negative impact from giving pembrolizumab earlier with CPS more or equal than 10, questionable for 5, and then for 1, probably unavoidable. So in my practice, 10 is the hard point that I use. Again, for these cancers, avoid dual checkpoint inhibitor strategies because of their higher toxicities, higher likelihood of patients being hospitalized. You really don't want your patients to end up in the hospital, especially these days. Consider pembrolizumab every 6 weeks, again, if we have clearance from insurance. So what do we do with our patients? If they're MSI high or EBV positive, and that's a low likelihood, we don't check for it routinely, but in endemic areas, you do. Pembrolizumab first line. For microsatellite stable, HER2 non-amplified, CPS score more or equal than 10, chemo first, then pembrolizumab second line. Same patients with CPS more or equal than 10, but their CPS score is less than 10, pembrolizumab in the third line after chemo followed by paclitaxel and ramucirumab. For those, of course, who are HER2 positive disease, treat with chemo first and de-intensify within 3 to 4 months. Your FOLFOX should go down to CAPE or to 5-FU or trastuzumab alone plus minus the chemotherapy standard.